Hello and welcome to The Blockchain and Us, where pioneers and thought leaders talk about their journey in blockchain technology, crypto assets, and the token economy. And I'm your host, Manuel Staggers. This episode has support from my very own The Blockchain and Us newsletter. Get an email from me every 2 weeks with a very short summary of new podcast episodes so you can immediately pick those interviews you'd like to listen to. To stay up to date, just visit www.theblockchainandus.com and sign up today. My guest today is Aparna Krishnan. Aparna is a Thiel Fellow and the co-founder of Mechanism Labs, an open-source blockchain research lab where she works on cryptography research. She was the head of education and executive VP at Blockchain at Berkeley, where she founded the education department. Aparna has taught the world's largest university-accredited blockchain course at the University of California, Berkeley, and she is also a mentor at SHE256. And now, to the conversation with Aparna Krishnan. Hi, Aparna, and many thanks for taking time today.
I'm excited to be here.
Let's jump right in with what Mechanism Labs does.
Yeah, absolutely. So Mechanism Labs is an open source blockchain research lab. We focus on doing consensus and scalability research. Mm-hmm. So right now the focus is a lot on practical usability of these different consensus and scalability protocols. So the reason we started Mechanism Labs was when we got into the blockchain space, it was really hard for us to understand what research exists and like how to dive into it. And it definitely didn't seem like there was a lot of peer review happening. And our goal with Mechanism Labs was to create this sort of community of people who are interested in doing academic research, who have some time on the side to all just join in and work on cool, interesting problems.
How did your journey begin into this whole space?
Initially, when I got into research, I was super, super focused on proof of stake. One reason that proof of stake was really fascinating to me was partly because it's this new energy efficient protocol as compared to proof of work. I definitely didn't think that proof of work was going to be long-term sustainable. Mm-hmm. And in order to build a scalable technology that lasted for years, we definitely needed to consider an energy efficiency into building something like that. And just the idea of how, up until proof of stake, I'd been super fascinated with cryptography, but just the dimension that proof of stake brought in with economic incentives was really, really fascinating to me. And that pretty much opened this like new area that people like to call crypto economics, token engineering, whatever different vocab they have for it. But it's this interaction between cryptography, economics, distributed systems, probability theory, systems theory, complexity theory. There are so many different fields like that merge into one, and that was really exciting to me.
Mm-hmm. But when you started getting into it, I mean, what kind of research did you find? You know, because I often do research about token economics, and it's very scattered.
Yeah.
And second of all, it's full of kind of, you know, Medium posts. And you never quite know, is this now just an ad or what is this really? So I'm wondering what your experience is there.
Yeah, definitely. So when I first got started doing this sort of crypto economic research, a lot of it was, hey, read this code that someone's written that is kind of broken, or read this spec that might change in the next 2 days, or read this Medium post. Mm-hmm. But a lot of it was on different forums, on Reddit. Very, very informal. And I definitely couldn't make out what was rigorous and like good collection of ideas versus what was just scattered different thoughts all around. And it was hard separating the two out until I sort of discovered that there existed these fields like distributed systems, which had been studying this in a very, very systematic process for years. And we're kind of reinventing the wheel by coming up with this new set of terminology to describe a lot of tools that we're using. But if we actually go back into existing literature, be it in mechanism design, or be it in distributed systems, or be it in cryptography, a lot of the concepts stem from there. And as I became more aware of that and started reading more textbooks surrounding that, my perception of the field and my intuition for what people would write in blog posts became a lot more accurate.
Mm-hmm. But if somebody wanted to learn about token economics, or maybe more specifically, staking economics, what should they read first?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think if they're a complete beginner, they should definitely start off with blog posts. So Mechanism Labs has written a series of introduction to crypto economics. We've also written a series that explores different proof of stake protocols, explains a lot of the basic theory that you need. I would say definitely start off with understanding the fundamental theory, and read blog posts which explain the theory as opposed to explain different protocols necessarily, because once you have the theory and once you have the framework in mind, then it's really easy to go with that intuition and be able to like read the first sentence of like someone else's idea or blog post and know what they're going to say exactly through the rest of it.
Mm-hmm. How long did it take you, you know, to wrap your head around some of these concepts of what blockchain companies out there in the field are doing, you know, as opposed to academic research? I mean, were there any gaps, you know, that you had to bridge?
I'd gotten into cryptography doing a lot of computer science and math Olympiad in high school. So I wouldn't say I formally studied it. I definitely read a lot of papers on the side by myself, or tinkered with things online by myself. So I think the biggest gap was in terms of vocabulary that people used, or in terms of like, so a lot of what I started to realize initially after I built up the intuition, when I was reading different papers, was that other people who wrote these different papers did not necessarily have the same kind of intuition. So they would like leave out really important parts. Like, for example, in distributed systems, if you're building a consensus protocol, it needs to have both these concepts of safety and liveness. But like, oftentimes people designing protocols would not necessarily understand or consider both of these parts or aspects.
Why is that, do you think?
I think part of it was because a lot of people think of blockchain as a new field that is completely independent of past concepts. But so they do spend a lot of time like rediscovering things that have already been discovered. So I think that is one of the biggest reasons. Another reason is definitely that this was something that I also found really hard when I started out with blockchain, was I didn't know what to start reading or what was good literature to give me that intuition. And the way that I learned was by having really good mentors or professors or advisors who pointed me to the right resources at the right time. And I think like a lot of people who don't have access to that kind of environment, even if they are really open to learning and changing their approach, they just haven't seen the right resources yet.
Mm-hmm. Cool. What is your process, you know, when you start, let's say, a new research project? I mean, what kind of tools do you use? How do you define the questions for research? How do you do all that?
That's a great question. And I think with any research paper, finding the right problem is just as hard as solving that problem. And I guess to find the right problem, it's definitely a process of like read enough to first scope out what's an interesting problem and then ask yourself, is it solvable based on your knowledge? And then if it's not, you kind of try to gain enough knowledge in the right areas that might help you solve it. And then if you've reached a point where you can clearly say this is solvable and you can use these are the techniques I've used and these are the approaches I've used to solve it. Then you do a deep dive into those approaches and techniques and actually go into solving it. But if you realize that there are no approaches or techniques that you can find that'll help you solve this problem, then you maybe go back to the board and like change the scope of the problem a little bit. And then iterate again.
What kind of tools do you use in your research?
I mean, one huge tool that I find helpful is Overleaf or LaTeX. Other things that I find really helpful for in general, just like brainstorming and putting my thoughts out, is Telegram and different forums where my initial ideas, if I'm looking for approaches on how to solve a problem, Twitter, Telegram, any of these community mediums of idea sharing are helpful to help me find what approaches exist. And I also, in general, like find that writing out code, writing out simulations is another very, very helpful way of approaching different problems. I think MATLAB and such are really helpful tools.
Mm-hmm. How exactly do you use these social channels for research?
So the way I use Twitter is if I have an idea and I kind of am, one, unsure if it's an interesting problem to solve, two, like what are different directions I can take it in, I'd probably like put out a tweet and see how other people respond to it. And then if someone comes out with really interesting responses, like I guess when I write any blog post, I try to put that into a tweet and then I send that out. Or like, for example, when I was trying to understand the differences, the subtle differences between plasma and sharding, I put that out as a tweet. I definitely find that Twitter is a really helpful resource because if you're able to reach people who have thoughts on that problem, they will definitely like tweet back at you or something. And then I take those conversations into direct message, or like I try to get coffee with them or something to then flesh out the ideas more or have a whiteboarding session with them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, awesome. And most people that you interact with, are they in your area or your environment, or are they pretty much international?
I would say a mix. I would say a lot of people, initially when I started out, most people were in the Bay Area. I think as time has progressed, I've become more comfortable interacting with people internationally and just taking calls instead of necessarily having face-to-face interaction.
Do you also work with partners, you know, companies who may benefit from a research question and who may also in return then fund some of the work you're doing?
So far, we haven't, partly because this is more just intellectual output for us. And it's been like, if someone's really interested in doing this research, it's less about monetizing it. It's more about finding a community of other people who can work with you on doing that research, and just doing it for the greater good, as opposed to like a certain kind of funding. Right now we have a few grants, like the Definity grant and UC Berkeley gave us a grant. So yeah.
Aparna, you're also a mentor for She256, mm-hmm. geared toward women in the blockchain space. Can you explain what you're doing there?
Yeah. So She256 is an amazing program. So one of my co-founders at Mechanism Labs, she also runs She256. Mm-hmm. And the mentorship program basically matches up different people in the blockchain space with new women who are interested in blockchain as a technology, and helps them have this sort of helps them have some sort of structure and someone who they can reach out to as they're going through this journey and learning about blockchain. So it could be all kinds of mentorship. It's a very, very personalized program. It matches up people based on their professional interests, based on their personal interests, where they want to, how they want to grow over the next year. So definitely very, very specific.
Okay. What are kind of the goals that your mentees have there in that program?
Yeah. So I have one mentee and she wants to, she's like working in the blockchain space and she wants to understand more about blockchain fundamentals. So kind of understand how to get started and what resources to read, all of that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. And I mean, in general, what, in your view, you know, what is it like to be a woman in this space? Because it's pretty male dominated. So I'm just curious about your take there.
Yeah, I definitely think being a woman in the blockchain space is hard. There are definitely times where there are a lot of like explicit or implicit biases which set in. Mm-hmm. A very, very simple example is, for example, like a group of guys might be bros and might like hang out and get some beer after work, but that's definitely not something that a girl would be part of. And oftentimes, like, it's in these sort of informal social situations that, one, you gather a lot of information, you share a lot of new things that are happening in the space, you chat about different things, and maybe even, like, build these long-term friendships, and these friendships help you make deals or, like, any of these little things that sometimes if you're a girl and you're not included in the similar conversations or in similar settings, you have to go above and beyond in order to build these similar connections. I would definitely not say that people explicitly discriminate. And I actually think the blockchain space is very unique in that people try to be as inclusive as possible, but it just so happens that a lot of these little implicit things add up to definitely make it a lot harder for women. But that's where I think initiatives like She256 are bridging the gap. And I think what they're doing there is really amazing. Mm-hmm.
Cool. I mean, if you look just as an example, right, let's say there's a startup with 10 people working there. How many people usually are women?
I would definitely say 1 to 2 at most.
Okay, 10 to 20%.
Yeah. I would say it's worse than traditional tech. I would say traditional tech is maybe 30 to 40%, mm-hmm. but blockchain space currently is still worse than traditional tech.
Do you have a theory why that is?
I think, one, it's a new space. It's very, very technical. It's very new. All of these kind of contribute to those who know others who are like already in it, kind of get into it. And the more bros who know each other, the more they get into it. But I definitely think that it's something that is changing, mm-hmm. and is likely to change over time. Another reason I generally see that as a trend is other traditional tech is like taught in university. There's like a proper educational program for all of that. Versus this is because blockchain is such a new space, there's no like blockchain degree that you can get versus you can get a data science degree. So traditional avenues of education don't exist, which means it's only people who know other people who are doing it who get into it. And most people who are doing it are guys. So other people who like hear about it, talk about it, also end up being guys.
Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a club mentality.
Yeah.
I mean, we spoke about it before the interview just briefly. And I mean, I told you there's somebody I know who has a niece who studied computer science for 4 years and then dropped out because it was just so difficult and there was just no nice future in sight. Mm-hmm. And I think that's quite sad. But how should somebody in such a situation, you know, who probably studied for a while, has maybe done a few internships and says, you know, I just don't really see where this can go for my career. I mean, what would you advise a woman or a girl in this situation?
I guess it comes back to, one, like, is it something they're passionate about? Because if it isn't something they're passionate about, they should probably be doing something that they care about more anyway. And if it is something they're passionate about, then I would definitely say, like, try to find other people who are passionate and more successful, and like try to reach out to them as mentors, advisors, and see how they can be helpful. Because oftentimes that kind of push is all that you need in order to keep going.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you also have a mentor yourself?
Yes. I definitely try to surround myself with people who challenge me in different ways, be it like in terms of business, be it in terms of like coding. I have a different set of mentors for different specific things. One of the mentors who's been really impactful for me is Manoush from Definity. She's an awesome researcher, and she worked with us on our first paper. She's in general been really, really supportive of, one, women in the blockchain space. Two, she literally gave us a lot of reading resources in terms of how we go about like mastering the basics. Other women mentors who've been really helpful for me were Elaine Shi, who's a Cornell professor. Mm-hmm. A lot of her influence has stayed on with my research interests. And I guess like I also have a mentor in Shi256. And he's been, Jameson has been like very, very impactful in shaping my views on how technology gets adopted in terms of privacy and in general, like the future of cryptocurrencies and usability around it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. What interests you so much in the blockchain and crypto space?
Yeah, so for me, I got into it primarily because of my cryptography interests, but also I see it as, I guess growing up, a couple things that I cared about a lot were freedom and privacy, just from a lot of personal experiences. And I see blockchain as the technology that...
What kind of experiences were those?
Oh, yeah. Like, for example, I was born in Oman and grew up... I was born in India, but grew up in the Middle East in Oman. Mm-hmm. And definitely, like, the culture there in general was a lot more restrictive, one, in terms of what you could do, in terms of like what you could think about, in terms of even what content you could consume on the internet. Like, if simple things like WhatsApp or like Skype were banned, it definitely felt very, very restrictive. And I definitely felt an infringement on my privacy in terms of like what I could access in terms of internet service providers constantly tracking all that we were doing in terms of like, I guess a lot of small instances which added up, and that made me really value both privacy and freedom. And I guess seeing the fact that countries like China or software like Facebook exists, and the fact that people and human relationships in China are hugely affected just because of a tracking software that someone built. Like, people won't even be friends with someone else because they're afraid that their score is going to go down by associating with someone who has a bad score is really crazy to me. And I think human relationships are really valuable to me. And the fact that these are affected by tracking software that people, one, don't even really want, but are just kind of like forced onto them, is really terrifying to me. And the way I see blockchain is the technology that gives back humanity a little bit of their freedom and a little bit of their privacy. And it's the anti-Facebook and it's the anti-China software.
Mm-hmm. That's well put. But I mean, let's hope that really happens because it hasn't happened yet. I mean, Facebook still exists. And
I don't think these will not exist. I just think that they will coexist with blockchains. And there will be certain times where it is very convenient to use Facebook, but there's certain kind of data that I don't necessarily want to share with everyone. And I should have the ability to control that.
Yeah. Do you use Facebook yourself?
I have a Facebook. I try to use it like very, very minimally. Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool. Yeah. I mean, is this something you're interested in? I mean, why not, right? I mean, in this space, it could be possible to raise funds and say, look, we're going to create a decentralized Facebook killer. I mean,
yeah, I definitely think that's a great idea.
And well, it's not my idea. I mean, it's kind of out there.
Yeah, yeah. And I definitely see a lot of promising teams working on that. Mm-hmm. And I'm excited for what comes out of it.
You were also teaching a blockchain course at Berkeley.
Yeah.
Now, what was the scope of this course and who took the class?
The blockchain class was more an introductory theory kind of blockchain class. Mm-hmm. And the kind of people who took the class were people who had no blockchain background. People, it could be both developers and researchers and business majors and econ majors, basically anyone who wanted to learn about blockchain. There was absolutely no restriction. The class was definitely more geared to teaching one about like Bitcoin, about its history, teaching about the culture behind blockchain, and then kind of leading into Ethereum, talking about the use cases that this technology could enable, and then in general, like other cool trends and future advanced use cases and advanced developments that were happening.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. I mean, I think it's always kind of a challenge, right, to get people interested in this technology and then also simplifying it just enough so you get them interested to learn more while not kind of, you know, dumbing it down too much. I mean, was there something that you learned teaching that class in getting people excited about this technology?
Yeah, I definitely learned that one, as the prices of Bitcoin went up, people's interest in the class went up.
Okay.
But in general, I did find that getting people to be more interactive with the technology and feel more part of the space definitely shifted their interest in the class. So as opposed to talking about these different people like Vitalik or Zuko or Vlad, or all of these people who exist in the blockchain space as figures who they couldn't relate to, if they went to a conference or if they went to a meetup or something and they met other people who were working in the blockchain space. So that I found was a really, really helpful way of getting people interested. Another way that I found was airdropping people money and getting them to actually use that. Another really interesting thing that I did was get people to write their own final project about something interesting that they would use the technology for.
Aparna, you also, I think you co-founded, or you were part of the founding team at Blockchain at Berkeley.
Yeah, I founded the education team.
What were the circumstances, you know, that led you to do this?
Yeah, so that's a great question. When I joined, Blockchain at Berkeley was transitioning from Bitcoin Association at Berkeley, which was 15 people who would talk about Bitcoin, into this consulting organization. And sometime then, I realized in order for it to scale up, it would need an education department, and it would, how are people going to do consulting deals if they didn't know about blockchain? So that was kind of the vision. Initially, it was about being the hub of education in the Bay Area. And then eventually it became just become a hub of blockchain education.
What kind of impact do you think blockchain at Berkeley has?
I think the impact it currently has in Berkeley is huge. It definitely also has huge impact outside of Berkeley. So the impact blockchain at Berkeley makes within in the education space, for example, is the online class, which over 50,000 people have signed up for. There are two classes at UC Berkeley, one developers class, another just an introductory class. Blockchain at Berkeley also is this really, really strong community of people in Berkeley who care a lot about blockchain. It's given rise to various different groups. So Decrypt Capital is started by the group of founders of Blockchain at Berkeley. Decrypt also has an executive education program, which started at Blockchain at Berkeley. Mechanism Lab started out of Blockchain at Berkeley. There's a group called Fourth State, which is implementing Plasma, which started out of Blockchain at Berkeley. So in general, it has impact in several different aspects of the blockchain space, but it's a tight-knit group of students who all share this huge passion for blockchain.
Now, you're also a Thiel Fellow, where Peter Thiel gave you a grant to work on Mechanism Labs. So how was your experience there?
He funded me to pause out of school and work on Mechanism Labs. So I would say the philosophy is more just like some ideas cannot wait. And it's not that everyone should drop out of school and build something. It's just sometimes like if you've hit upon something that is so promising and you're not able to balance school with that idea, or like school is actually taking away from your ability to work on something that's much cooler and much bigger, I think pausing out is not a bad idea. And I would definitely like, I think after taking the fellowship, I realized that a lot more. I think when I was in school, there were points where I would go weeks without sleeping much, just because I couldn't work on research and blockchain and do school and be like on top of everything. And I think the fellowship has been a great opportunity to do exactly what I want to do.
Mm-hmm. But do you think universities can even play a leading role in these new technologies, or is it more projects like yours, you know, that live outside of academia that have an edge in this blockchain research field?
I think there's definitely value in both university and in startups that exist outside of university. I think university is a great place to educate masses. Like, for example, if there was a blockchain degree program in like Stanford or Berkeley, I can see how impactful that would be in like getting more passionate people or getting more people aware of this technology and getting them passionate about it. On the flip side, I also think that if there are already people who are super passionate about something that they're doing, then maybe a university program cannot provide them the kind of education that they need in order to be the most successful. So I think university is great as something for the masses and for the average person. And I think programs like the fellowship are also great for people who already have that kind of, have an idea of what they want to do with their life.
Cool. And who wants to be average anyway?
I mean, I would not say it's like who wants to be average anyway, because no one, like, it definitely takes a lot of time in figuring out like exactly what you want to do, and having the ability to take that kind of risk and commit your life to a certain cause. And more, I would definitely say a lot of people don't know what they want to do or where they want to be in the next 5 years, because that's a very, very hard question. And I think for people who have an answer to that, maybe university is not the right place.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. What are you advising, you know, maybe girls that you work with in SHE256 who are in this situation, who say, should I continue my education or should I try something on my own, do my own thing? What's your advice there?
I definitely think like taking hedged risks is a really important aspect in doing anything in life. Like, for example, if you know that there's something you're passionate about and you've discovered it, I definitely think doing everything you can to kind of manifest that is like just take the leap of faith. But if you don't know if you're passionate about something and you're just exploring and you're trying to figure out, mm-hmm. I definitely would not advise dropping everything else in your life to just explore.
How did you find your passion?
I guess for me, it was always clear very early on that math and computer science were things that I cared about. Maybe even since I was like 6 or 7. And it just became more and more clear to me over time, through actions I would take, through situations I was in, until at some point it just became that I had to take the risk and the passion was obvious to me. Like, for example, with blockchain, when I was in Berkeley, there were weeks where I just couldn't sleep because I was so engaged with the research I was doing, and I really enjoyed learning about blockchain, and I spent a lot of my time just doing that, and I really wanted to just be focusing on that, but I also was kind of afraid to just pause out of school or like let that go away. So that was a very clear signal that this is something I'm passionate about, and I should take that leap of faith, because yeah.
Do you have any role models?
I definitely think I have people who I look up to as mentors in different aspects. I don't know if I have a single role model, because I try to learn as much from everyone I meet, and everyone I meet has something new to teach me. Yeah, and a role model would kind of imply that there exists one kind of perfect person, which I don't think exists.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. What's your main focus now in things that you want to learn for yourself at the moment?
So I think personally, I'm really focused on cryptography, improving that knowledge.
Mm-hmm. And other than technology, you know, maybe things that are just important, you know, functioning in the world.
Oh,
or are there any things there that you're currently working on for yourself?
I definitely like value personal growth a lot. So understanding myself, understanding, just being more emotionally aware, meditating. Those are things I care about a lot. I also, in general, like reading different things. I definitely tried to read like different physics books or different history books or just different things to keep myself mentally engaged. And occasionally I like to dance, but those are just things that I do outside of work.
Which are very important as well.
If I have time, yeah.
In your view, what are the most interesting questions currently in blockchain technology that you think are worth researching?
That's a great question. I think one thing that I've been thinking about recently is with respect to open sourcing code, like can you have certain properties about technology, about code without necessarily open sourcing it? Because the reason like private companies exist is because like capitalism works really well. But for example, if everyone started open sourcing all of their products, what prevents other communities from just forking all of this and becoming a long-term sustainable business? And I think if there is a way to maybe like not have to open source code, but still verify that there are properties about that code that exist, that would be a really cool topic of research. I definitely think there's a lot of areas of research around zero knowledge proofs and how they could be applied. Similarly with verifiable delay functions and where they could be used in consensus randomness. or maybe just in like other parts of technology, incentive mechanism for different proof of stake systems is another really cool and open area of research.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. You're like 21 or 22 years old?
Yeah, 21.
21. Do you already have a vision for what you'll be doing when you're 31?
Well, I hope I'm still doing blockchain when I'm 31. And I hope the technology is so successful that I get to keep doing that for the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. Imagine you had something like a magic wand or like one wish or something like that. What do you think should massively improve in the world?
Maybe just people should be more aware and mindful of themselves. That's something that should massively improve.
What do you think are maybe important takeaways, you know, for people that they should take from the things we spoke about?
I guess one important takeaway that I've been thinking about a lot recently is we're building this really cool technology called blockchain, but who is it going to benefit and why are we building it? Because right now, I don't see people using it yet. And that's something that's been on my mind for the last few months. And I think we're building really cool and interesting technical things that are intellectually so challenging and interesting, but I definitely don't know what problem we're solving in the world.
What kind of problem would you like it to solve?
I guess certain sets of problems that it could solve, or I think this is my thesis, is it could help provide access or provide financial inclusion for people who don't have it right now. So basically unbanked populations. I'm sure there are other things, but we definitely haven't built all the tools or all the things necessary to solve other things. Like if we want a decentralized Facebook or any such thing, we don't have all the different components yet anyway.
Yeah, definitely. Still much more research is necessary and much more work to be done. That's for sure.
I would actually say not much more research and work, much more targeted research and work. So figuring out what end value you want to create and then working backwards as opposed to just creating intellectually cool things. I think creating intellectually cool things is really valuable too, but figuring out how all of these intellectually cool things that we've created are going to work together to create that final value.
Yeah, this was great. Thanks a lot for your views and explaining what you're doing. This was really great. Thanks a lot for taking time.
Cool. Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us today. More info on our guests and our sponsors is in the show notes of this episode and on the podcast website, theblockchainandus.com. To help people find this podcast, it's important that you download, subscribe, and give it a top rating and review on iTunes or on the podcast platform of your choice. I'm Manuel Staggers, and I thank you very much for listening.